In 1944, a month after the Allied invasion of Normandy, the United States and Britain, along with delegates from 42 other wartime allies, met at the Mount Washington Hotel near Bretton Woods, New Hampshire. John Maynard Keynes, then the world's most famous economist, represented Britain, and representing the United States was an economist who is less remembered today, Harry Dexter White. In his new book, The Battle for Bretton Woods, John Maynard Keynes, Harry Dexter White, and the Making of a New World Order, Council on Foreign Relations economist Ben Steele portrays the lead negotiators and their efforts to design a global monetary system to be managed by an international body. It's published by Princeton University Press. I'm very pleased it has brought Ben Steele to our show today. Hello.
Thanks for having me.
The meeting was called the United Nations Monetary and Financial Conference. Did they believe that the war in Europe was in its last year?
They believed that they were at the beginning of the end. This is July 1944, so just 3 weeks after the D-Day landings at Normandy. So there's a real sense of sort of anxious optimism in the air among the 700 delegates from 44 allied nations.
And they're already thinking about post-war monetary policy?
They are. Remarkably, Harry Dexter White, who's really the father of this conference and the International Monetary Fund that was set up through the conference, as early as 1936, I found memos in his files when he was no more than a bureaucratic temp at Treasury, when he's already planning an international monetary conference.
Because of the disaster that occurred after World War I, did they want to avoid a similar problem?
That's right. The Treasury under FDR were very much economic determinists. And they believe that it was the currency wars that began in the early 1930s after Britain left the gold standard that gave rise to the trade wars that spread the Great Depression globally and created this environment of misery and anger that paved the way for Hitler and Mussolini's march to aggression. So they were determined to use these economic institutions to keep the peace after the war.
It's noteworthy that they used the term United Nations a year before that an organization called the United Nations was even created.
That's right. In fact, the International Monetary Fund and the World Bank that were set up through Bretton Woods were very much intended to be political complements to the United Nations that was set up the following spring at San Francisco.
What was the outcome of the conference? Did it prove to be as important as the participants had hoped?
You know, it did, in the sense that it really enthroned the U.S. dollar as the global unit of account after the war. It confirmed the United States as the unrivaled global superpower. The British Empire began unraveling after Bretton Woods. So it wasn't quite the kumbaya moment that people typically see it as being, but it was a very important event for the way it contributed to U.S. hegemony after the war.
And was that the goal of FDR? To make the dollar the world standard?
It wasn't. FDR, like Churchill, did not view economics as a geopolitical tool. But it was the two treasuries, the U.S. Treasury and the British Treasury, that drove the details of the events. And FDR's treasury was ruthlessly determined to exploit Britain's pending bankruptcy during the war in order to remake the global order after the war.
Well, all of Europe was going to be in disarray of one sort or another, including all of our ally, the Soviet Union. So this was a real opportunity for the United States.
It wasn't very, very much so. FDR's treasury sort of forced Britain into a Faustian bargain. For 2 years in the run-up to Bretton Woods, they had very tense negotiations in which the U.S. demanded three essential things. First, that after the war, Britain end imperial trade preference, the arrangement by which Britain gave itself privileged access to its the markets of its colonies and dominions. It demanded complete convertibility of the pound sterling, which was a mortal threat to British solvency because Britain had very little gold and U.S. dollar reserves. And finally, the United States demanded that Britain accept the U.S. dollar as the global unit of account after the war. But as British delegate Lionel Robbins put it at Bretton Woods, quote unquote, we needed the cash.
How much attention did the American public give to the meeting? Did many have a sense of its potential significance?
It was a true media event in a way that Paris in 1919, which was the last major international gathering, wasn't. There was a massive press contingency at Bretton Woods, and FDR's Treasury were very determined to manage it. The star of the show was John Maynard Keynes, the British representative, and the American media was fascinated with him. But the American Treasury were determined to keep him out of the spotlight. For example, Henry Morgenthau, FDR's Treasury, wouldn't let Keynes speak at the opening ceremonies or even nominate him to be president of the conference, and Harry Dexter White sidelined Keynes at Bretton Woods, putting him in charge of the commission to create the World Bank in order to keep him away from the central event, creating the IMF.
Even though he was one of the most respected economists in the world at the time.
He was certainly the most renowned economist in the world at the time, one of the world's leading public intellectuals, and indeed the first international celebrity economist.
And also, if we are trying to avoid the problems that followed World War One, he had predicted all of those problems when he was very young, an economist in his 20s at the end of World War One.
Yeah. During World War One, Keynes worked for the UK Treasury. In fact, he made his first official trip to Washington in 1917, a begging mission, as all his missions to Washington were throughout his career. He was at Versailles representing the British, and he wrote a very famous and scathing book on the Versailles Peace Treaty after the war, called The Economic Consequences of the Peace, in which he did, in fact, predict that the Versailles terms imposed by the United States in particular would lead to war down the road.
My guest is Ben Steele, S-T-E-I-L. His book, The Battle of Bretton Woods, John Maynard Keynes, Harry Dexter White, and the Making of the New World Order, published by Princeton University Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. We heard the phrase the New World Order after the fall of the Soviet Union. Were they actually using the phrase at this time?
No, they weren't. But there's no doubt that they had a sense that they were creating one. This was an extremely volatile period. 3 years later, in 1947, the Marshall Plan essentially overthrew some of the key foundational thoughts that underlay Bretton Woods, in particular the notion that Britain was going to be a geopolitical rival to the United States again, the notion that the Soviet Union could be co-opted into a permanent peacetime alliance. These things were fundamentally revisited.
Was the Soviet Union included in the delegates at Bretton Woods?
They were, and Harry Dexter White in particular was determined to make sure that they would sign on to the agreements. They were very obstructionist at Bretton Woods. They really weren't interested in this new international monetary system. There were just two things they were after. First, they were trying to get cheap short-term credits from the United States, which Stalin could eventually repudiate at his will sometime down the road. Second, they liked the idea of a new international monetary system being founded on gold again, because the Soviets had a lot of it under the ground, and they obviously wanted to boost the value of the stuff.
Did anyone foresee that the Soviet Union would become the opposite pole to the United States in the post-war world, not Britain?
Oh, sure. There was a real sort of battle going on within the FDR administration in terms of how the administration should position itself vis-a-vis the Soviets after the war. Broadly speaking, within the U.S. Treasury, there was a sense of romanticism about the Soviet Union, this so-called one-worldism. Within the State Department, there were, however, deep skeptics, people like George Kennan, who became much more important after the war.
Well, Harry Dexter White, we will talk about later, had another relationship with the Soviet Union. But Allied leaders met many times during the war at Yalta, Tehran, Potsdam. The United Nations Charter was drafted during a meeting in San Francisco in 1945. Was this all part of a deliberate effort to set a new world order, to set the world on a new path? And where did Bretton Woods rank among those meetings in retrospect?
In retrospect, I would put it rather low. And the reason for this is the romanticism with regard to the Soviet Union, the notion that the Soviets could be co-opted into this permanent peacetime alliance. That was rudely interrupted by events shortly after Bretton Woods. The Soviets, who did sign on to the agreement at Bretton Woods, never actually ratified the agreements and never participated in them.
And much of it really didn't go into effect until many years later.
This is a point that people often aren't aware of. A lot of people refer to the Bretton Woods era as being from roughly 1945 after the war to 1971. And indeed, that was an era in which there was a significant economic recovery around the world. However, the first nine European countries to meet the requirement that their currencies be convertible into U.S. dollars after the war didn't actually meet that requirement until 1961, by which time the Bretton Woods system was already coming under enormous strain as the U.S. was losing gold reserves.
These days, we see disagreement between U.S. government departments. Were the differences between state and treasury over Bretton Woods?
Huge. The State Department was very interested in establishing a new multilateral trading system after the war in which British imperial trade preference would be removed, but they didn't really care about currency issues the way the U.S. Treasury did. For the U.S. Treasury, Harry Dexter White in particular, making the U.S. dollar the global unit of account was not only critical to reestablishing global multilateral trade, but critical to eliminating Great Britain as a political and economic rival after the war. That was a priority for the Treasury in the way that it was not for the State Department.
But could it have gone any other way? The United States was the country that came out of World War II in the best shape.
That's true. But John Maynard Keynes, for example, on the British side, was very much criticized by senior civil servants on his own side for being overly wedded to this idea of a grand design, creating this Bretton Woods, when in fact what Britain really needed was short-term financial aid with as few geopolitical strings as possible to survive the war. But Keynes was very wedded to the notion of establishing his political legacy after the war. He wanted to be known as the man who overthrew the gold standard. And so he overlooked some options by which Britain could have maintained some control over the dissolution of its empire after the war. For example, borrowing money privately rather than through the U.S. Treasury.
Well, we'll take a little break, and when we come back, we'll go over the details of the Bretton Woods Agreement from the gold standard to the new monetary system as we continue this conversation with Ben Steele, who's a senior fellow and director of international economics at the Council on Foreign Relations. His new book is called The Battle of Bretton Woods, John Maynard Keynes, Harry Dexter White, and the Making of a New World Order. It's published by Princeton University Press. We are back with Ben Steele. His book, The Battle of Bretton Woods, John Maynard Keynes, Harry Dexter White, and the Making of a New World Order. The International Monetary Fund and the World Bank were designed at the conference. What were they intended to do? Pretty much what they've continued to do since?
No. In fact, both institutions have changed very radically. The purpose of the IMF, according to White and Keynes, was to provide just short-term balance of payments assistance to countries that would be short of dollars for a brief period of time after the war. It was certainly not supposed to be a crisis firefighter in any way, and it was to support a system of fixed exchange rates in the world. Of course, we don't have any such system today, and the IMF is constantly working on putting out financial fires around the world. The World Bank was actually established to promote reconstruction in Europe after the war, and of course, instead, it's emerged as a major international development organization.
Well, the Marshall Plan replaced it.
Completely. This is one thing that many people don't realize about Bretton Woods, that after the war, President Truman effectively mothballed the institution. It did nothing for many, many years. The idea behind Bretton Woods was that loans to dollar-starved allies could restart a multilateral trading system, very much like Germany seems to believe in Europe today, that loans to crisis-stricken countries in southern Europe can revive the European economy. That didn't work after the Second World War, and the Marshall Plan replaced this idea entirely.
And I'm not sure it's going to work in Europe today either, but that's a
whole
other issue.
I think you're precisely right on that.
At the beginning of the 20th century, the gold standard had been the basis of American and British monetary systems. How did the gold standard work? Did you really need to have an equal amount of gold to the amount of paper money that was out there?
No, you didn't. You needed to have a limited base of gold in all the participating countries to make the system operate. But after the First World War, the system that made it so successful in the late 19th century broke down entirely. There was a mechanism to keep countries in rough balance. That is, before the First World War, when gold flowed into your country, you lowered interest rates. When gold flowed out, you raise them. That broke down entirely after the First World War.
And then you had the Great Depression.
Then you had the Great Depression. One country after another went off of the gold standard, so you had the beginnings of currency wars. Germany triggered a lot of the international trade wars. Germany couldn't devalue after the war because their debts were fixed in gold terms according to the Versailles Treaty, so devaluing would have been devastating to them in terms of being able to pay off their debts. So they used protectionist trade measures.
But what was the thinking of economists in 1944 about the gold standard? Because some countries remained on the gold standard, didn't they, after Bretton Woods?
After Bretton Woods, all countries in the system were fixed to the U.S. dollar at a fixed exchange rate, and the dollar itself was fixed to gold at a rate of $35 per ounce. The fatal flaw, however, in Bretton Woods was there was not actually any mechanism to make sure that the U.S. could actually meet its obligations to exchange gold for U.S. dollars. And in fact, what happened in the 1960s is that countries like France started demanding their gold back. This eventually resulted in Richard Nixon closing the gold window in 1971, ceasing convertibility of the U.S. dollar into gold permanently.
And now we have people who are saying, let's go back to it. We recently had David Stockman as a guest on the show. Ron Paul is pushing for it again. Do you think that's likely?
In my view, totally unrealistic. There's no prospect of any government around the world ever being willing to tie itself down by the necessity of supporting a fixed exchange rate with gold.
Now, I would understand why the British sent somebody with the prestige of John Maynard Keynes to Bretton Woods, but did he work well with others?
He did not.
Did they hope his stature would carry him through?
Well, there was a beautiful piece of British doggerel from the period that really explained the British thinking. It went like this. In Washington, Lord Halifax once whispered to Lord Keynes, "It's true they have the money bags, but we have all the brains." That is, the United States might have the purse strings here, but we had the brains. We had the man who knew how to renegotiate this architecture. But Keynes was extremely condescending and rude to his American counterparts, and this made their task all the more difficult.
Did the Americans get a sense that the British felt that they had all the brains?
Oh, absolutely. And this came across in particular in the negotiations between Keynes and Harry Dexter White, who came from very different backgrounds.
But wasn't Keynesianism already partly adopted by the FDR administration? So did Keynesian economic thinking dominate despite whatever people thought of him himself?
Absolutely. In fact, I would argue that the United States was more passionately religiously Keynesian in the 1940s than Great Britain ever was.
So let's talk about Harry Dexter White, who spearheaded negotiations with Keynes and the British.
Right.
What can you tell us about
Harry Dexter White? Is truly one of the most fascinating American political figures of 20th century that people really know nothing about.
He didn't get along well with Morgenthau, did he?
No.
Secretary of the Treasury?
He had a very tight, I would call it a symbiotic relationship with Morgenthau. They arrived on the scene at the Treasury at roughly the same time. Morgenthau was appointed FDR's Treasury Secretary in January of 1934. Harry Dexter White was just a bureaucratic temp at Treasury at the time. But Morgenthau knew nothing about economics. Harry Dexter White was a supremely ambitious man with an enormous talent for translating economic ideas into policy. And the two of them abound in a very uncomfortable way over the course of their career. Morgenthau, for example, didn't want White to get credit for his ideas. But White was also aware that if his ties to Morgenthau's or Morgenthau's to the president were to be severed, he would be sent back to his small college in Appleton, Wisconsin, and that's certainly not what this man wanted.
Well, how did White and Keynes get along?
Supremely badly for much of the time. They had a grudging respect for each other. Keynes understood that White was enormously influential within the administration. White, for his part, worshipped Keynes as a thinker. He used to get physically sick before going into negotiations with the man. But at one point, they had a famous flare-up in October of 1943. Keynes took White's new draft for the IMF, hurled it to the floor, and yelled, "This is intolerable. It is yet another Talmud." He was very conscious of the fact that White and his key deputies, indeed Henry Morgenthau, his boss, were Jewish, and this would come out in his frustrations, to which White responded, "And we will try to find something which your highness can understand."
But there was a hint of anti-Semitism there, which couldn't have played well with the Americans. Astonishingly, we now know that White admired the Soviet system. How far did his admiration go?
Well, White is truly a paradox in the sense that he was a staunch American monetary nationalist who was determined to enthrone the U.S. dollar as the global unit of account after the war. But he was also very much throughout his career a political romantic. He was always wedded to non-mainstream politics. In 1924, for example, he was a passionate supporter of Fighting Bob La Follette's Independent Progressive Party campaign for the presidency on the basis of nationalizing key industries, ending imperialism in Latin America. He was studying Russian in 1933 and planning to go to the Soviet Union to study economic planning. The following year, he gets invited to Washington, gets enmeshed in a web of fellow travelers. This is a heady time in terms of diplomatic politics. 1933, the Soviets join the the Soviets are accorded diplomatic recognition by the FDR administration. 34, they join the League of Nations. And Harry Dexter White, remarkably for the better part of his 12-year career, acts as a mole for Soviet intelligence. He feeds classified information to them. He advocates for them in policy discussions, and he places key individuals of importance to Soviet intelligence in positions in the FDR administration.
So did he believe in the communist economic system?
He was definitely not a communist in terms of political ideology.
So why would he be a mole?
This is a wonderful question, and indeed the reason why I think the White case has been as controversial as it has been over the years, more controversial than, for example, the Alger Hiss case. I would describe the White case as a sort of murder mystery where you have the witnesses, people like Whitaker Chambers, for example, who pointed out White before the House Un-American Activities Committee in 1940 as a Soviet agent. You had the murder weapon, as it were, classified information in the form of a handwritten letter that Chambers turned over to Richard Nixon in 1950, but you had no real motive. But in the course of my research, I found a fascinating letter of White's in his archives, written in 1944, in which he blasts Western and in particular American hypocrisy towards the Soviet Union and extols the virtues of Soviet socialism. He ends by paraphrasing the famous radical American journalist Lincoln Steffens, who after visiting Petrograd in 1919 said, "I have seen the future and it works." White writes, "Russia is the first instance of a socialist economy in action, and it works!" Exclamation point. He was a true believer in the success of Soviet socialist economics.
So he must have really had all sorts of split thinking when he's engaged in these negotiations. He was called before the House House Committee on Un-American Activities in August 1948. What happened to him there?
You know, he put in a bravado performance. He was actually continuously receiving applause from the peanut gallery in the background. He presented himself very much as a loyal American in the progressive tradition. There was only one member of the committee who I think was effective in interrogating him, and that was a young 35-year-old congressman named Richard Nixon, who kept trying to set White up for a perjury charge. He kept asking him in different ways, do you know Whitaker Chambers? Have you met Whitaker Chambers? To which White kept responding studiously, I do not recall. Several days later, he died of a heart attack.
Now, you say that White would not take orders from Moscow. He worked on his own terms.
Absolutely.
So he saw himself as an outsider above the potential Cold War?
Yes. He was very frustrated by isolationism in the United States. He didn't feel that the United States was providing the Soviets with the assistance that it should have been, and he was willing to cross the line in many cases in order to help the Soviet cause.
So in the end, what did the British and Americans get out of the Bretton Woods Conference? Hadn't Keynes sought a new international reserve currency? What would that have been?
That's right. He wanted to create a new supranational currency, which would be called the Bancor, which would eventually, he hoped, supplant the U.S. dollar as the global unit of account. Of course, White and the Americans would have none of it. There's one very important legacy, I think, of White's freelancing diplomatic activities, however, that lives on from Bretton Woods to this day. In January of 1946, President Truman is going to nominate White to be the first managing director of the IMF, the head of the IMF. But when FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover gets wind of it, he prepares a long memo for the president arguing, don't even think about it, I can prove that the man is a Soviet spy. And in order to keep this spy scandal from emerging, the Truman administration concocts this new narrative that they take to the British, whereby they argue that we've decided, after all, that we really want presidency of the World Bank and not the IMF, and we left presidency of the World Bank to a European, and that tradition lives on to this day.
On the other hand, the dollar has remained the international currency, and even with the strength of the euro at its height, it never was a challenge. We've heard possible challenges from Japanese currency, now Chinese currency. The dollar still remains the standard. International leaders like the former French President Nicolas Sarkozy have called for Bretton Woods II. What would he hope to have hoped to achieve before he was voted out of office?
Well, I think he, like Keynes, wanted to see a system that would be much less reliant on the U.S. dollar. I think that the key problem from getting from here to a new Bretton Woods is that there's just no deal to be done between the world's largest creditor and the world's largest debtor today the way there was in the 1940s. China today is the world's largest creditor. The United States is the world's largest international debtor.
But considering all the problems that we are seeing in Europe with Greece, Spain, Ireland, Portugal, etc., wouldn't some new conference well, I guess that's what the G8 is all about, isn't it?
It is, but the G8, mind you, has really become little more than a talking shop. And Bretton Woods, I should emphasize, was not—
With the
not...
United States listening in. Well, that's a whole other story.
Very much so. But Bretton Woods was anything but a talking shop. This was kabuki theater, very much scripted by Harry Dexter White and the U.S. Treasury. They used remarkable ruses to push through things at Bretton Woods that the other delegations wouldn't agree to. If you're going to get a new Bretton Woods today, before you march into the negotiating room, China and the U.S. would have had to have found some basis of agreement, and I just don't see it there right now.
And since Bretton Woods really never had the impact it was supposed to have, does it really matter?
I think
it's like the Kyoto Protocols. Everybody signs on and then nothing happens.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. And the United States at Bretton Woods did establish the U.S. dollar as the world's supreme currency, but was unable to push through the other aspects.
Ben Steele's book, The Battle of Bretton Woods, is published by Princeton University Press. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thanks for having me.